I'm Patrick Wilson, and this is the Run to the Top podcast.
Hello, fellow runners. I am your host, Finn Melanson, and this is the Run to the Top podcast, a podcast dedicated to making you a better runner with each and every episode. We are created and produced by the expert team of coaches at runnersconnect.net, where you can find the best running information on the internet, as well as training plans to fit every runner and every budget. How many times have you been in a training run or race environment where issues like nausea, bloating, or cramping have interrupted performance? Or how often have you tried to experiment with the latest drink mixes, gels, and bars, only to find yourself back at square one, wondering what will keep you properly fueled and focused on the task at hand during prolonged exercise? Personally, I've lost count of how many times gut distress and nutrition choices were the limiting factors on my performance in these scenarios, and that is why I'm excited to have Robert Wilson, a professor of exercise science and a registered dietitian, on the podcast today. Robert wrote a book a few years ago called The Athlete's Gut, The Science of Digestion, Nutrition, and Stomach Distress, and we use his work in this area to talk about the sources and remedies for common gut distress issues that runners face, as well as overall strategies that runners can implement to make sure that they are in good positions from a nutritional standpoint to execute their most important, most challenging runs in training and on race day. If you're looking for a way to naturally boost energy, enhance athletic recovery, and get the most from your training, then you should take a look at adding essential amino acids, also known as EAAs, to your pre- or post-run drink. I'll go over the benefits later in this episode, but if you want to see some of the research yourself, head over to getkeon.com/run to the top. Before we get to our conversation, I wanted to talk about the importance of electrolytes, especially in the winter. Maintaining healthy electrolyte levels is not only important for your run, but your recovery and overall health as well. That's why we recommend all runners check out Element this winter. It's loaded with everything you need to replenish your electrolyte balance with 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium, and doesn't include anything you don't need, like extra sugar or anything artificial. Stay tuned for how you can get a free sample pack at element.com. That's LMNT.com/runnersconnect. All right, Patrick Wilson, welcome to the Run to the Top podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the invite.
So I'm excited to chat with you here for many reasons today. First off, we're going to be going quite in depth on your book, The Athlete's Gut, and, you know, in my free time, I am an amateur ultra runner, and I've lost count of how many times nutrition choices and gut distress was the limiting factor in my performance. So just having read your book, it was invaluable in uncovering areas where I could do better and troubleshoot. And just excited to cover parts of it in the conversation today. So thank you for your work in this area.
Well, I appreciate that. And the positive feedback is always nice. You hear a lot from runners, especially ultra runners. I mean, that's, I think, the community that deals with it the most in terms of impacting their performance and even their training. You see some studies where it's 40% of competitors in a race say that it impacts their performance. So, yeah, obviously, I think almost every, especially ultra runner, has had some of their own experience where it's been a problem enough that it's impacted them negatively. So you hear that a lot. And that was, you know, part of the impetus for writing the book.
There's a couple questions I want to ask you to set the table for a couple other topics we'll go in depth on. The first, what were your own professional and lifestyle experiences that motivated you to put all this work together into a book?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was a combination of my research agenda over a period of a few years just started gravitating more and more towards gut issues with athletes. You know, I had done some studies as a PhD student that looked at feeding with distance running and how that may impact physiology and performance. But one of the measures that I took was, kind of gut symptoms or gastrointestinal perceptions. So the major study that I was doing in the lab was basically a protocol where people came in and they did two runs on the treadmill. Each of them was 2 hours at a set pace, roughly. I think it was 60-something percent of their VO2 max. And then they did a four-mile performance test at the end. One condition, they were ingesting a beverage that had all glucose, and then the other condition, it was a mixture of glucose and fructose. And one of the measures that we were taking was gut symptoms. And just my experience from that and seeing the impact of just carbohydrate source and how that can impact how people feel and how they perform, how their gut functions, was kind of the initial study that I did that looked at that. And then I just became more and more interested in it over time. As a athlete myself, I've personally never had major issues like regularly that some athletes experience, but I'm not an ultra runner. Played basketball, did distance running, but the farthest I've really done for races is half marathons. So it was more coming from my own research experiences and just kind of seeing that in certain areas of the research, there just wasn't much there. So kind of was an opportunity for me to explore some things that hadn't really been looked at as much. So kind of a combination of things, but it was just a natural progression over time of where my research was.
Very cool. Well, there's one other question I wanted to ask, and I think this will be important just to sort of define terms and set up the rest of the conversation. You spend the first few chapters of the book providing an overview of gut anatomy and physiology. And for non-scientific folks like myself, I appreciated the analogies to like the automobile assembly line and the interstate highway and the gut acting as a quote unquote second brain. Are there any, given that this is a large topic to dive into, are there any summary key points you could provide about these two areas of science that would be helpful for the rest of the conversation, especially as they're relevant to runners?
Yeah, I think in terms of just gut anatomy and function, I think an easy way just to remember what your gut is doing is breaking down the stuff that you eat into small components that can actually be absorbed. Because when molecules are too large or substances are too large, it's, the body doesn't want those circulating around. And you're not able to absorb these larger molecules, complex carbohydrates or even carbohydrates peptides, which are amino acids that are, multiple chains in length. So a molecule that's got 4 or 5 glucose units, your body's not going to absorb that. You need to really break it down into individual sugars. So that's obviously a major goal of the gut, is to break down and then absorb the stuff they're eating for the purpose of supplying your body with energy. Beyond the energy function, or the needs of the body would be, micronutrients, vitamins and minerals that play a role in metabolism and growth and all sorts of things. So that's a priority. And the easiest way I think for people to conceptualize this is it becomes more chemical the farther you get down into the gut. So it starts out very mechanical in terms of how you break things down with chewing, movement of muscles in the tongue and the mouth. And then as you go farther and farther along, as you get into the small intestine, the stomach, it becomes more chemical in nature. The stomach is kind of a good mixture of mechanical and chemical, where there's a lot of churning, a lot of squeezing going on to kind of mix things up and continue to break them down physically. But there's also enzymes that are breaking down the nutrients that you're consuming. And then as you get into the small intestine, of course, it's a tube that is kind of contracting and propelling things. There's not as much mixing, so it becomes a lot more chemical. It's the enzymes that are splitting apart those larger molecules into smaller things that you can actually absorb. So as you get farther and farther down that tube, it essentially becomes more and more reliant on chemical digestion. So I think that's just something kind of to keep in mind in terms of the function of the gut and how that may impact people. Like, what would be the practical application of knowing that is, if you don't split apart these larger molecules, they can't be absorbed. You might say, okay, so what? They got to go somewhere. they're going to end up going out the other end of you if they don't get absorbed. They're going to end up causing havoc in the intestines and then especially the colon, if you're not absorbing sugars, for example, the bacteria are going to all feed on them and eat them. And that produces gas as a byproduct. You also get water pulled into the tube because water is attracted to molecules like sugar. So that's a practical consequence of not being able to absorb what you're actually eating is gut effects, including cramping, loose stools, bloating, gas. That's pretty specific to carbohydrate malabsorption, but if you don't absorb the nutrients that you're ingesting, it's going to be a problem in terms of the way you feel eventually. So yeah, that's kind of an overview of just how I like to think about it as it goes from very physical, mechanical to more chemical in nature. The goal being to absorb what you're eating as efficiently as possible. And you don't want a lot of stuff left over, especially like a lot of carbohydrate, for example, can cause a bunch of symptoms that aren't pleasant or are not conducive to performance.
This is a question I've always wondered about, and I think you're the perfect person to ask it. If you think about the physical performance realm or the mental performance realm, we talk about people that just have like genetic or biological advantages in those areas of athletics. Is it the case that there are people out there with quote unquote elite gut performance? Like they can just digest food without needing to train it to the same level that the common person like myself might need to, or is the gut system trainable to the same extent, or are we born with the same processes across the human race?
You know, Finn, that's a good question. And I honestly, it's something I've thought about a fair amount. I do think that they're probably like any characteristic or any body system or any feature of physiology, that there are some people who have anatomy or physiology that predisposes them to having either more or less gut issues, especially with exercise. And that could, for example, it could be the size or location of some of the blood vessels that feed the intestines. You know, if someone has smaller blood vessels or something like that, or arteries, you know, with heavy exercise, they may have more limited blood flow, for example, as compared to somebody who has, you know, different anatomy. And the reason why that could impact you is if you've got less blood flow to the gut, it tends to cause some dysfunction. You know, you don't have oxygen and nutrients flowing as much as you want. So that's an example of how like anatomy in theory, you know, could have some impacts. Or if someone has like advanced heart disease or arterial disease and they've got blockages that prevent blood flow to the gut, that could be problematic. Now, in terms of genetics, I honestly, my guess is that there are certain things in terms of genes that would predict people having more or less issues, for example, with exercise in terms of their gut function. No studies, to my knowledge, have looked at that. I've thought about trying to design a study to look into that. I don't do gene sequencing, so that isn't my area of research. There could be twin studies we could do where we identify, you know, identical twins that exercise and run and see how much they're reporting in terms of their gut issues with exercise and compare that to non-related people or non-identical siblings, with the idea that if there's some sort of genetic component here, you'd think that there's going to be, you know, probably more similarity among people who are genetically identical, you know, if they're identical twins. But long story short, there's not any research that I'm aware of specific to exercise and gut issues and function that has looked at, you know, genetics, for example, what role that plays. But I don't think anybody should ever be surprised by a study that says genetics impacts this. Of course it does. Like that's what we are. We're basically, you know, these bodies walking around that are largely controlled by our genes and the interaction between our genes and the environment. So I think, yeah, some people have an iron gut. Some of that, my guess is probably their anatomy and their genetics plays a role in that. How exactly it does that, you know, very, very much unknown at this stage.
Fascinating. And I know we're going to get into this a lot in the second half of the conversation, but you mentioned in the book in numerous chapters about strategies that runners can deploy to train their gut to get used to the foods that they're going to consume on race day and just to avoid problems in later stages of the race. But you also mentioned that there is evidence out there indicating that if you sort of just wait out this process and you stay in the running game longer, that you just as a function of being in the sport for like 10, 15, 20 years, a lot of these gut issues may subside. And I guess the question I have here is like how long, like A, did I describe that correctly? And B, like how long do you have to be in the sport until you enjoy the benefits of just like a gut that's accustomed to the demands of running?
That's a good question with, you know, a nuanced answer, I think, in that we see that in surveys, more experienced athletes, runners tend to report fewer GI symptoms with their training and with competition. Now, those are just observational studies, and it's not, you know, conclusive that it's actually directly due to experience. It could be other things like, you know, more experienced athletes are also older. So is it a product of aging and not necessarily experience itself? That's an unresolved question. But there are studies that show over a period of months, more experimental studies or studies that look at the physiology of what's happening, is that as people train and become fitter, the reductions in blood flow to the gut with exercise at a given workload become attenuated or lower. So you seem to be able to adapt better and handle a given training load without having as much of a reduction in blood flow to the gut. You know, in terms of symptoms, I think it's complicated because I've heard, you know, lots of runners and athletes who get better over time. I think that's the average experience, is that you probably experience fewer problems from most people. It's probably a combination of getting fitter. There's some physiology behind that. You're also just getting more experienced with how much can I eat beforehand? How much can I eat during? You know, there's things you might kind of figure out over time that come with experience. But for some athletes, like I get sometimes emails from people saying, you know, I used to be able to do, you know, an ultra race or an Ironman, but the last 3 years I've suddenly developed nausea and I throw up at every race. And they're very experienced athletes, and it's hard to figure out what is that. I think on average, though, most endurance athletes tend to get a little bit better with experiencing GI issues, symptoms. They have less of that overall, but it's not, I wouldn't say that it's a massive effect. You know, it's not like you go from someone who starts out, they've got a ton of issues, and then you can just expect all those to go away, you know, with a year of training. It's more of a modest association in these studies. So combining all the evidence together, it's one thing that does play a role, but I think it's one among many. And you shouldn't necessarily expect, as a novice or a new runner, if you're having a lot of issues, them just to go away on their own after a couple of years. There's probably other things going on with it that's contributing to those problems, whether it be poor nutritional choices or, you know, anxiety or stress or medication use or something else that's underlying those problems. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, it's multifactorial. It's not, you know, a single one thing. Occasionally it's like someone just did something real dumb or a poor choice, you know, with their pre-race plan or during training. And it's like, yeah, if you just don't do that, you're not going to have a problem. But in a lot of cases, it's a mixture of things.
I wrote down three common gut symptoms here that runners often experience and that play a significant role in curtailing performance. I figured we could kind of go through each of them one at a time and talk about maybe the common ways you found work to resolve them. The first being nausea. So when you think about nausea in runners, in what circumstances does this typically occur in the context of running? And what do you see as the best ways to combat it?
It's one of those where it hits the extreme. So it's short, high intensity stuff and then super long stuff. That's prolonged, like ultra races, where you see the highest prevalences. So, you know, if someone's doing a hard interval workout or something like that, they can experience some decent amount of nausea. You know, if you're doing a middle distance race, something like that, obviously can also happen. And then as you get into the ultra territory, I mean, surveys from like the Western States Endurance Run, I think, if I remember correctly, I mean, it's
Marty Hoffman,
in the ballpark of 60% that have some nausea. Now, most people, it's not extreme, but that's a very high, you know, percentage of runners in a race reporting nausea. You don't typically see that with shorter races like a half marathon or a marathon. So the causes in both of those situations may be different though, right? So with high intensity exercise, short duration, it's probably the stress response, the increase in adrenaline and catecholamine hormones that might trigger what's called basically the vomiting center in the brain to increase these feelings of, you know, like having to throw up. So there's other studies from different realms that suggest that those stress hormones do play a role in nausea. So if people are fasted, which increases stress hormones, you're more likely to be nauseated with exercise. If you ingest caffeine, a lot of it, before exercise, you're more likely to report nausea. And caffeine also increases stress hormone secretion. So that's one example I tell people is, like, if you're doing a workout in the morning, you don't eat much, you drink a bunch of coffee with a lot of caffeine, and then you do hard workout and you feel nauseated, that's probably a potential reason why. Now, in longer duration stuff like ultras, that's a tougher question that I don't think there's a clear answer to. I think part of that is because it's very difficult to do experimental studies with ultra runners, because if you're going to bring people into a lab and try and isolate things that cause nausea, you'd have to ask people to exercise on a treadmill for like 10 hours. And those are just, you know, difficult studies to do. So most of what we know about ultra running and the physiology and nutrition and that stuff comes from just surveys and observations that happen at races, which is fine. But it does make it tough to kind of tease out exactly what is going on. My guess is it's a combination of stress hormones, are the hormones that might trigger nausea, arginine vasopressins, a hormone that's secreted with exercise that also in some studies has been linked to nausea. Heat load, heat stress will definitely do it. So if someone is competing in a hot environment, that is going to likely exacerbate it. There's other like muscle breakdown products that build up in the blood with ultra races that theoretically might contribute. So there's just like a stew of stuff. If you exercise for 15 hours, that starts to accumulate in the bloodstream, that might be triggering nausea, is my guess. But that's hard to isolate and prove that it's exactly that. It's still a, you know, kind of an unanswered question with ultra races. How do you really get a handle on it? What are exactly the mechanisms involved? And it's, you know, it's kind of ubiquitous for ultra runners to experience it at some point or another. And there honestly at this stage is a, I think some ultra runners, you just have to expect that you're going to have some nausea, you know, with that extreme. You might have to adjust your fueling. You might have to maybe look at trying some sort of medication and seeing if that helps. I think the reality is it's somewhat inevitable for some runners with that that level of effort. So, you know, I know runners don't like to hear that, but if someone had an easy fix to it, you know, it would be in widespread use and you'd see, you know, runners having some success with it. But it's a tough nut to crack for long distance stuff.
Another reason I would assume for mental skills to be so important on race day and in problem solving, troubleshooting. What if any, like solid recourses do runners have to combat this issue, in your opinion? Like if you were experiencing nausea, what would be your checklist of fighting it?
Yeah, I would look at, you know, potential triggers, which can include, you know, things like consuming too much caffeine. You know, caffeine's a performance enhancer, but if you've got a lot of it in your system, especially you're someone who's sensitive to it, that might be something to look at. Certainly, if you are underfeeling or overfeeling, it could contribute, especially with an ultra race. If your blood glucose levels are, you know, trending downwards, you haven't been able to eat all that much, or you've been behind on eating, theoretically, that could play a role. But if you're overeating, I think that's probably the more probable cause. And, it, you know, the gut is struggling, I think, to digest stuff the farther you get into an ultra race, because it's just a stress on the gut. And if you're throwing a lot of stuff down the hatch and it's starting to slow down and build up in the stomach, that can be a problem. So training, yes, training the gut during your you know, weeks and months leading up to a race, if you're not habituated to eating during those longer runs, you should really be trying to practice that and getting accustomed to it if that's what you expect you're going to do on race day. So I think that can help attenuate some of the symptoms that arise from eating. You know, there's some other things, like, interestingly, I've got a master's student who's going to be doing a thesis here in the next few months where we're looking at the extent of chewing and how that impacts digestion, metabolism, and perceptions with endurance running. Because in non-athlete studies, the amount that people chew foods, and this is solid foods, seems to impact how fast it might empty from the stomach, how quickly it's integrated into the bloodstream, and just the perceptions that they might feel. So some studies that have looked at feeding people bars with exercise have shown that they do elicit more GI symptoms, including nausea and bloating. So if you add that up over like an ultra 15 hours, if people are eating more solid foods, but they're not chewing them thoroughly, in theory, that could kind of lead to stuff sitting in the stomach. Now, that's theoretical. We'll see if that actually plays out in the study that we're doing in the next several months. But for those athletes who are primarily choosing solid foods or a good amount of solid foods, that's something I would actually think about, is that do more work here in your mouth and make your stomach do less work, because it's already under enough stress, right? Like, you don't want to just gobble down a slice of pizza or something like that without really chewing it, because you're, you know, extremely hungry at an aid station. It sounds good to you. And I know not every ultra runner is using solid foods like that, but if you are, that is something to ponder over. And then, yeah, I mean, you got to kind of trial and practice out the different foods and products you think you're going to use on race day, and hopefully dial in as best as you can. And then the last thing, I guess, would be, you know, trying some anti-nausea medications or supplements that at this point don't have much direct evidence that they actually work in ultra races. But, you know, if you've got nothing else, I guess it's potentially worth trying. I think, you know, as long as you think about it and make sure you're not overdosing with any of these things, or especially with any prescription medications, you're talking to a sports med doc about it, or someone who is going to be prescribing those medications, and getting an idea about whether or not that's something worth trying.
If we move on to bloating, what are the most common causes in running events? And again, here, what's your checklist for remedying the issue?
I think that one is actually a little bit easier to isolate. Nausea, I think, out of all of them, is the hardest to kind of get a handle on, because there's just so many different potential causes. Bloating, I mean, you think gas buildup, right? That's kind of what bloating is buildup of gas. And it's not necessarily just the buildup of gas. It's also people's just perceptions of how they feel. You can feel bloated without necessarily having eaten something that produces a lot of gas. So it's a combination of things producing gas, and then also how you perceive that in terms of how people will report their level of bloating. So usually, though, with bloating, it's something's being fermented in the gut. There's gas being produced, and that kind of is filling up the intestines and kind of putting pressure on the wall, which you're going to feel as bloating, right? Is the most basic thing you can kind of think about. So when I think about sources of gas being produced, it's usually carbohydrate being fermented. And that produces things like hydrogen and carbon dioxide and methane, gases that, you know, will in large amounts or in greater amounts lead to some feelings of bloating. So I'd look at, what are you eating beforehand? How much fiber? How much of what we call FODMAPs? Those are fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, polyols, these kind of short chain carbohydrates that some people don't absorb super effectively. So you could look at your intake of those. If you've got a high intake, that might be something to target. And yeah, and then also what you're consuming during the event. If you're overloading the guts with too much carbohydrates, you can get some inefficient absorption, and that could also cause bloating. So those would be the kind of the main things I would look at. You might taper fiber intake before competition. You might taper FODMAP intake. You know, you might also, again, make sure you're paying attention closely to how much carbohydrate you're consuming during, and making sure that if you're going to consume a lot, that you definitely train your gut to do that.
Every runner wants more energy, more stamina, and less soreness, right? On our recent episode, Everything You Need to Know About Amino Acids for Running Performance and Recovery, we went into how amino acids are the key to unlocking these three benefits. So if you haven't listened to that episode, definitely check it out. But here's the gist of why amino acids are so important for runners and for fitness in general. In a nutshell, they are as essential for life as water. In fact, amino acids are the most abundant substance in your body after water. A whopping 50% of your solid muscle mass is amino acids. And this is why supplementing with essential amino acids, also known as EAAs, can take your training to the next level. Your body can make most amino acids on its own, but not EAAs, so you need to get all 9 of them through diet or supplementation. Taking EAAs will give you more energy without caffeine because they directly stimulate cellular energy production. They also counteract central fatigue and prevent muscle fatigue during training, giving you more stamina to run faster and longer. And taking EAAs will also help you recover faster because they reduce muscle damage from exercise, which is what makes you sore. Keon Aminos, the fundamental supplement for fitness, contains all 9 EAAs, is backed by over 20 years of clinical research, is super clean, and tastes amazing with natural flavors. So, if you want to naturally boost energy, enhance athletic recovery, and get the most from your training, you need to get Keon Aminos. To save 20% on monthly deliveries and 10% on one-time purchases, go to getkeon.com/run to the top. That's spelled GETKION.com/RUNTOTHETOP to get our fundamental supplement for fitness, Keon Aminos. Did you know that you're likely to sweat as much, if not more, in the winter as opposed to summer? That's because we often wear such warm clothes to start our runs, which leads to more sweating towards the end. Plus, the sweat gets absorbed by our clothes, so it's harder to notice. Now, you already know that when you sweat, you lose electrolytes, which are essential for your body's best performance. But you've also been told that too much salt is bad for you, so it can get confusing to know what to do. The truth is that athletes, healthy eaters, and heavy sweaters all need more sodium, and just about everyone needs more potassium in their diet. And we don't need a bunch of sugar and artificial junk along the way. Element is the hydration solution designed with athletes and everyone who sweats in mind. Element comes in lots of salty flavors that even the saltiest sweaters will love, such as citrus, raspberry, and orange. It even comes unflavored for those who prefer the clean, salty taste. That's why we recommend all runners check out Element this winter. It's loaded with everything you need to replenish your electrolyte balance with 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium, and doesn't include anything you don't need, like extra sugar or anything artificial. Even better, they are currently running a special deal where you can get a free Element sample pack with any order. So, order your favorite flavor and get a free sample pack to try out new flavors or share with your running friends. To claim this exclusive deal, you must go to drinkelement.com/runnersconnect. That's drinkelement.com/runnersconnect. Can you talk actually about feeding tolerance and absorption capacity and like this idea of a max rate of stomach emptying? Because I think that would give listeners a good idea of, well, if I eat like this much carbohydrate in a given hour, I may overstress the system, and actually like my body's not even capable of digesting the number of grams I just took in. So I think that'd be a good thing to talk about here before we go to cramping.
Yeah. First, I guess fluid. There's studies that, you know, that have looked at feeding people different amounts of fluid and different beverages with exercise. And once you get above 1 liter per hour, that gets to a territory where some people are going to have maybe difficulty kind of getting all that out of their stomach, because there is a, you know, there's an upper limit to how quickly you can empty fluids. Now, most runners don't approach that anyways. Most runners are not consuming over 1 liter per hour of fluid, but you might see that actually happen sometimes with cyclists. So that might be something that they should be cognizant of, just you know, there is, for most people, you know, you're not going to go above 1 to 1.5 liters an hour. It's just too much. Now, in terms of carbohydrate, it's not necessarily as much about gastric emptying as it is probably about how much of that is absorbed in the small intestine. And, you know, glucose and fructose are the two main sugars that are included in most sport nutrition products. Mm. Sucrose is as well, but sucrose is a mix of glucose and fructose. And for each of those sugars, it seems like there's maybe an upper limit of, you know, somewhere between 45 and 60 grams an hour that you can actually reasonably absorb. If you go above that for either sugar, it's more and more likely that some of that is not going to be absorbed. And when it's not absorbed, right, it kind of hangs out in the gut. It attracts water. So water gets pulled into the gut. You know, you can get loose stools, gets fermented, causes gas. So the general rule of thumb is that if it's just one source of sugar that you're using, max amount for most people is probably going to be around 50 to 60 grams an hour. Mm. If you combine glucose and fructose, it ends up being higher than that, probably 90 to 120 grams per hour, we've seen in some studies, but that is not for the faint of heart. So even if theoretically that is the max rate, if you haven't practiced that and you haven't given your gut time to kind of upregulate some of those transporters or doors that allow those sugars to be absorbed into the cells and blood, then you're probably going to have some issues. So that's kind of the overall is once you get above 60 grams an hour, you're getting into a territory where you definitely want to train that. I guess some people have an iron stomach that can handle it no problem, but most people, especially with running, where there's a lot of jostling up and down, you kind of need to get accustomed to that if you're going to try that. So I know like in the marathons reportedly, you know, Kipchoge, you know, maybe around 90 to 120 grams an hour from what I've seen from different sources. But not every athlete needs to go that high. I mean, it is also for higher level runners that are burning a lot of carbohydrate, right? If you're a slow runner and you're not, number one, expending as much energy anyways, and it's a smaller proportion as carbohydrate, there's no real reason why you would need to go that high because you're not even burning probably that much carbohydrate per hour. So those targets are for the higher targets are for more developed, elite, highly competitive runners. Going beyond, an hour and a half to 2 hours is when you would start to even think about consuming that amount of carbohydrate. If it's a shorter race, there's no reason to consume that much.
The last symptom I want to talk about before we move on to some other nutrition stuff is cramping. So in what circumstances does this often arise? What are the remedies in your opinion? And then could you also talk about how sodium supplementation might not necessarily be the answer in some of these cases as well?
Yeah. So abdominal cramping, we can kind of think of cramping as right abdominal intestinal cramping. We can also think of cramping as muscle cramping in the legs and things like that. So it's important to distinguish between those two. In terms of gut symptoms, intestinal cramping, a lot of times it's similar things in terms of if you're not absorbing things, there's fluid being pulled into the gut from the bloodstream. There's some muscle contracting in the walls of the gut that kind of causes maybe a feeling of a cramping sensation. So certainly can be the same things that cause bloating that you'd expect to see. Unabsorbed carbohydrate will cause a sensation of cramping. But it could be other things. It could be certain medications can do it. Sometimes if you take a lot of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like NSAIDs, that can do it. If you've got a GI illness, you know, some sort of foodborne illness, obviously, I think most of us have had an experience where you kind of have some of those perceptions as well. So that could do it. People who have a lot of anxiety at least perceive maybe cramping to be more common. Exactly. Is the physiology actually different underneath in terms of they're actually experiencing more muscle contraction in the walls of their intestines? Hard to say, but they may perceive that symptom as being more severe under a given set of circumstances. So those are some examples of things that, you know, you could take a look at as being potential causes. Because usually that's what I recommend is you try and find the cause as opposed to putting on like some sort of Band-Aid, whether it be through medication or something else, like a short-term medication. trying to identify what might actually be contributing in your individual situation. So those are some things people could look at potentially.
Let's talk about fueling strategy. And I think this is, it can be a large debate in our community. If we're looking at carbs versus fat, in what scenarios is it prudent to fuel with one over the other? Is it situational, or is it always the case that there's a clear fuel source winner, in your opinion?
And is this, are we thinking during the event, or is this globally in general?
Let's do during event.
Okay. So during event, it's primarily going to be carbohydrate. And the rationale for that is, you know, for the most part, even a super lean runner has enough fat stores to, you know, supply what they need during the event itself. Usually the limiting factor for most athletes, again, those who are working at a higher intensity, this is more true for, is, you know, your storage limit of carbohydrate. For most people, it's going to be, you know, something on the along the lines of a couple thousand calories worth of carbohydrate storage. More than that, if you're loading and you're eating a lot of carbohydrate, you know, you can definitely increase that baseline amount. But as you're burning through that, and your stores start to get low in those muscles that are repetitively being used, you know, there's going to be changes in the ability of your muscles to contract at a given rate once you start to rely more on fat for fuel. It is a less efficient fuel when you compare it to carbohydrate in the respect of for basically a given workload or intensity. If people are burning fat versus carb, their oxygen use is actually higher when they're burning fat at a given workload. And that's because it's a fuel that requires more oxygen to basically break down. Now, it's not a massive difference, but it is a less economical fuel. So for like a marathoner, like a standard marathoner who's, you know, elite and exercising at 90% or more of their VO2 max for the marathon, they're burning almost entirely carbohydrates. Now, there's some fat, but it's at the elite level, it is almost all carbohydrate. And they're going through those glycogen stores, those carb stores very quickly. And the only feasible way that they can maintain the intensity that they're aiming for is to actually consume some carbohydrate during the race itself. Because once you start relying on fat, in most cases, you're going to slow down a bit. Now, for an ultra runner, it's a different story. I mean, if the race is done over 12 to 24 hours and the average VO2 max intensity is 50%, you know, you're less reliant on carbohydrate in the first place. So, you know, I think it becomes a lot more difficult to exactly say what is the right approach for ultra runners. I think during the event, though, still probably the priority is carbohydrate mainly. Pre-event, though, chronic diet, that's more debatable exactly, you know, which of those is more advantageous. Are they basically, you know, equivalent? My guess is it probably depends on the athlete. To some extent, there may be some advantages to a high-fat diet for some athletes. Like, let's say they do have a lot of feeding intolerance with carbohydrates, and they don't want to have to rely as much on carbohydrate during the event. Maybe going on a high-fat diet, consuming a smaller amount of carbohydrate during the event is going to be helpful for them. But if you've got an athlete that's got an iron stomach, and they can ingest 60, 90 grams an hour, no problem, for 12 hours, you know, they're probably going to be the type where eating a high carb diet in general is better for them. Because if you try and eat 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate after eating a high fat diet, your gut is not really accustomed to that carbohydrate load if you're traditionally eating a high fat diet before the race. So I think it's the pre-event diet where it gets more difficult to say, you know, what's a rule of thumb. For ultra runners and ultra endurance athletes, for standard marathon and shorter and at elite level, I don't really think there's a whole lot of debate among most nutritionists and physiologists that do research in that area that higher carbohydrate is generally going to be better than low carbohydrate in those events.
I'm starting to see a fair number of products brought to market that include a few grams of protein in the gel, for example, and I'm curious, is there any method to that madness? Does protein have a role to play in supplementation during or feeding during a race environment?
My sense is that it's mostly, if there's the benefit, would be on recovery in terms of going towards the next, you know, exercise session or bout, whenever that is, if you've got a relatively short turnaround time and you're looking to, you know, maybe enhance your recovery over the next 12 hours, I think ingesting some protein with carbohydrate during the exercise itself may be helpful in some cases. In terms of just sheer performance, no, I don't really think that most of those products, there's much science behind, you know, any real advantage to having protein in there. Yeah, I think the studies that show that, you know, either they didn't have an equivalent amount of energy provided. So like they added some protein to a beverage, but they didn't add some extra carbohydrate to make those two beverages equivalent in terms of energy. Mm. So that's one example of some of the methodological things with some of the research in that area that make it challenging to kind of just say, is it the extra energy in the protein that you're getting, or is it just, you know, something unique about the protein itself? I think mostly though, it's going to be if you're going to exercise again soon and you're thinking about speeding recovery, that would be where I would probably think there's a benefit. Direct performance benefits itself, I don't really see much research there suggesting that that's really a big benefit.
Gotcha. Please fact check me here because I was taking notes from the book and I may have misrepresented some of the findings, but my understanding is that if you're running an event that is at or less than 2 hours, the research suggests that you should just drink to thirst. Is that correct? And if so, could you talk about why that's the current conclusion in the scientific community?
Yeah, that is one of the most debated things with during event nutrition is how much you should drink. I think over time, kind of the extremes of the different camps, there's kind of been a drink to thirst always is best. There's been an approach where it's like, no, you need to know your sweat rate and measure that and, you know, replace a certain percentage of your losses. And I think over time, those extremes have kind of moved a little bit closer together. I think there's pretty good agreement among people that I've talked to with shorter events, less than 2 hours, assuming you start off well hydrated. That's the assumption, is that you're starting off well hydrated, that you probably can just use thirst. And there's not really a reason necessarily to have to know what your sweat rate is and get real complicated with the replacement rate, because it's just not enough time for most people to accumulate a big fluid deficit. You know, 2 hours, yes, maybe if you've got an elite runner who's exercising at a very high intensity in a hot environment, that might be different. You know, you do have very large sweat rates there. You can lose, you know, 5 or 6 liters of sweat in 2 hours. So I think maybe even in that 2 hour range, there might be some cases where having a more structured approach could be helpful. But most runners, most cases, less than 2 hours, I don't think you really need to probably overthink it a whole lot, because there is a risk of overdoing it. You know, if you let's say you calculate your sweat rate to be 1.5 liters an hour, and you say, I want to replace, you know, 2/3 of that, because that's what this paper or book says, that's 1 liter per hour. I mean, that's a lot of fluid for people to handle. And if you have not practiced that, it is not going to feel comfortable for most runners. So just blindly looking at a recommendation from a textbook or an online article or even a journal article where they say, you know, replace as much of your sweat rate as possible, that's not going to be reasonable in every case, especially for people who have higher sweat rates. It's just, you think through it logically, it isn't going to work practically for most runners. So I think shorter races, yeah, most of the time you can just use thirst as a guide as best you can. Longer races, that's a different story. There's a lot more debate there. Some people still say that thirst is just the easiest approach. I think others would argue that for some athletes that works fine, but others, for whatever reason, they just kind of underdrink and they do accumulate kind of a fluid deficit that is harmful to performance. So I think there's more ambiguity there. I think you got to kind of experiment yourself and see what kind of seems to work out. One thing you could do is, you know, if you've got a training run that's 2 or 3 hours or even a race, look at your weight change before and afterwards and see where you're at with, you know, a drinking to thirst strategy. And if you're still in a seemingly a big deficit, that might be a sign that, hey, I might need to take a little bit more of a structured approach here than just kind of saying, okay, I'm going to drink when I'm thirsty.
So in events like the half marathon or the marathon or ultras where you're going over 2 hours and you use the term like fluid hydration plan, In those scenarios, are you recommending drinking at regular intervals?
Yeah, one way you could do it is if you are concerned about under hydration, or even over hydration sometimes, if you've got a slow runner, you know, they stop at every aid station and they just drink, you know, they drink to thirst and they end up gaining weight over a race because they're drinking so much. So I think there's a risk of both under hydration and over hydration sometimes with the thirst approach. So how you could handle that is you could go and do a 1 or 2 hour run at the pace that you think you're going to run that race at. Okay. Measure your weight before and afterwards. It's easiest if you don't drink anything during that hour, and you measure your weight difference. And that's basically your sweat rate, because anything you're losing in 1 hour of exercise, the vast majority of that is fluid. It's not going to be a lot of carbohydrate or fat that you're burning. I mean, there's some mass you're actually breathing out. There's carbon molecules you're breathing out that are coming from the fat and carbohydrate that you're burning, but it's a small amount. So the weight change in an hour over exercise is almost 100% fluid loss. So if you know what your fluid loss is in an hour at that pace you're intending to run at during the race, you've basically figured out your sweat rate. So if you lost 1 kilogram in 1 hour, that's basically 1 liter per hour of fluid losses. Now, what do you do with that information? You say, okay, I guess I want to maybe target, let's say, 2/3 of that. I want to try and replace 2/3 of that, because if my race is 10 hours, if I'm only replacing half of that, that's going to add up to a massive deficit by the end, for example. So that's an example of how you could use a more structured approach, but obviously requires more effort and time. You need to know what your sweat rate is under a variety of conditions and paces, because those are the main things that impact sweat rates, pace and environmental conditions.
I want to talk about supplementation before we close up. And I've really enjoyed this conversation, by the way. I really appreciate it. For context on this next question, about 2 weeks ago, I was down in the Phoenix, Arizona area, crewing a friend at a race called the Javelina 100. And one of the cool things about this race is it's a loop race. So there's this whole tent city that forms around the major aid station there. And I'm super curious. So I'm walking around and I'm seeing the runners, seeing their crews. And one of the most common supplements that I saw at the race was these bottles of exogenous ketones. And I talked to a lot of the crews. I talked to some of the runners post-race. And I'm like, why these ketones? And their theory was that as the race duration increased, supplementing with these ketones, it was sending energy to the brain. It improved cognition. They were not forgetting to eat. They were making better steps on the trail. And they were just more like mentally in it to persevere through pain. And I guess my question is there any sense to what they're saying there? Is any of what they're saying backed by the research? Or is this still early days and none of those claims have any basis in the research?
I mean, I think it's definitely still early days with the ketone research. I mean, there are some suggestive studies that that show that it might influence metabolism or the fuels that you're burning during exercise. There are some studies, not as much with exercise, but there are some that it may impact cognition and, you know, those types of things, decision making. This studies overall with exercise, actually, most of them have been shorter duration. So I think it's hard to extrapolate what exactly that's doing at hour, you know, 10 of a ultra in the heat or something like that. My, I guess, thought on that is if they're using it and it doesn't cause them problems, because one side effect of ketones in high dosages is gut distress. So there's some studies that have shown reduced performance because they had ketones administered before exercise, during exercise, in relatively large amounts. And yeah, they can cause gut issues. So that would be my kind of recommendation to somebody is, you know, if you're going to use it, make sure to try it out and make sure it doesn't cause you any of those issues. Otherwise, if it seems to be helpful for you, there's not a lot of research to say definitively that it's helpful or harmful or neutral. You know, feel free to give it a go. I don't think there's a whole lot of harm to it, assuming it's not causing any gut issues. I think most athletes, in terms of aversions to it, would be the taste. I bought some of it and tried some of the most common product on the market, common brand, and I mean, it kind of tastes like flavored rubbing alcohol. And the cost is actually fairly high as well. Crazy. If you're going to like supplement it throughout, you know, a race. I mean, I think most people who are willing to do that are willing to, you know, spend some money on it. But the main product on the market that I'm aware of is quite expensive because of the R&D that went into developing it and making a pure product. So it's one of those where it's definitely popular in a lot of endurance sports. I mean, the Tour de France, I know a number of teams have been using ketone supplements and becoming more popular in ultras. I'm sure we'll have more research coming out on it. So it's an interesting, it's an interesting phenomena and the use of it. I don't really have any good solid scientific answers for you in terms of whether it's really worth their time or effort.
But yeah,
like a lot of those supplements, if it's not doing any harm and you want to spend the money on it, I don't necessarily see there's a problem with it, assuming you're getting it from a company that is legitimate and is actually making ketones and it's not just a bottle of nothing, because, you know, supplement regulation is pretty loose in most countries, including the United States, and some supplements don't have in them what they say they have in them. So that's the only caveat, I guess.
Well, one of the takeaway, and you just mentioned it, one of the takeaways I got from your section on supplementation is that there should be a lot of skepticism about what's out there on the market. This is not necessarily a question about supplements, but the energy gels commonly used among runners, like made by Goo and Spring and Morton. I almost without fail, like it's an exception to the rule that runners that are incorporating them into their nutrition strategies, they, especially in ultras, so maybe not in the road scene, but they lose their tolerance for that source relatively early in the race. And so I guess my question here, and it's a loaded question, but how far off the mark, in your opinion, are these companies from creating something that can be sustainably consumed all event long? And should that even be the mission of what they're creating?
I mean, the flavor fatigue thing is definitely real. I mean, athletes kind of just getting sick of consuming the same thing, whether it be the flavor, the consistency, or whatever else. And I think a lot of those products were kind of developed originally with the idea that they're going to be used during half marathons, marathons, those types of events, maybe an Ironman in certain parts of the race where you're going to be using them, but not necessarily, you know, most athletes just eating gels for 15 hours straight. Not that they don't market those products that way, but I think originally a lot of these sport nutrition products were meant largely for stuff that was intended to be shorter, because that's where most endurance athletes were, you know, when a lot of these products started hitting the market was that, I mean, of course, Ironmans have been around a long time, but ultra running has kind of exploded more recently. And yeah, I don't necessarily think just relying on gels is a good idea for an ultra race for any number of reasons. It can be the flavor fatigue issue, you know, it can also be later on the race for some athletes. It's, you know, it's a big kind of dose of carbohydrate at once. And that can be, you know, something that sits in the stomach a bit like a brick if you're not really used to it. I think that if an athlete has no problems with them, it's a easily digested, consumed source of carbohydrate. From that perspective, I think they're great. But when as the race gets longer and longer and longer and the intensity gets lower and lower and lower, your ability to probably handle some more solid foods, you know, might go up. So I think if you are the type of person that has trouble with flavor fatigue or just getting these gels down without feeling like you're going to, you know, throw them up, mixing it up and using other things, whether that be, you know, pretzels or gummy bears or raisins or whatever you want to use. I mean, I think the key is just you've had some experience with it, you've practiced with it. When it comes down to it, most of these products are just sugar. And most of them, it's not like the science behind them is magical. It's the only real science, I think, that is backed up pretty strongly is that if you're going to ingest a lot of carbohydrate, you want a mixture of glucose and fructose. And most products have a mixture of that, some in different ratios than others. But there's nothing magical about most gels. It's just it's a processed carbohydrate that's fairly easy to digest and fairly easy to consume quickly. And when you're exercising at a high intensity, most people prefer something that's easy to get down. You don't see marathon runners stopping, you know, to chew and throw down a bar because it's counterproductive to their performance. in an ultra race where you've got more kind of ability to vary what you eat to some extent, I think it's, yeah, more commonplace where you're not going to be relying just on gels and goos and things like that.
Couple more questions for you before we close up. The first, and I'll ask this question with the assumption that listeners have the time and the resources to invest in this area, but are there any tests or lab protocols that you recommend runners go through, like sweat tests or other nutrition tests, to get to know their gut better, their biology better, so that when they're creating a nutrition strategy for a race, they have as many of the facts as possible?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, I know there's, you know, there's a possibility of trying to standardize, like bring an athlete in, have them exercise for an hour or two. You could, in theory, feed them a set amount of carbohydrate and look at their responses both perceptually and physiologically. For example, one thing you can look at is markers of carbohydrate malabsorption, where you'd have people breathe out into a specialized device that measures the amount of hydrogen and methane that they're expelling. Because when you have a lot of carbohydrate that's not being absorbed, that's the production, what is being produced is those gases. And some of those gases actually get absorbed in your bloodstream, and then you breathe them out. So if you see someone with spikes in the amount of methane and hydrogen that they're breathing out, it's suggestive that they're not absorbing carbohydrate as efficiently as they might want. So some studies that have done gut training protocols have used that as a marker of carbohydrate malabsorption. Now, if you could work with the lab or something like that, they could theoretically do that sort of testing. You could kind of do before and after gut training to see whether you're improving. But there are no there's no standard just run-of-the-mill tests. You can just go to any exercise physiology lab or clinic and just get ordered and say, hey, you know, I want to know how my gut's going to handle this. It's, and I think largely because there are so many potential causes of gut issues that it's, you know, it's frustrating for athletes, I think, when they ask about, like, how do I fix this problem? And it's oftentimes difficult to identify what are the causes. And then oftentimes it's more than one cause that's involved. So it's a challenge, I think, to get it fixed and to get it improved. But standardized tests, I mean, there's not really anything I would recommend across the board. Sweat tests, you could make it simple and do what I just described and do an hour or two of exercise at your race pace and measure your weight before and afterwards. And assuming you didn't drink anything during that hour or two, you can know what your sweat rate is. That's a pretty easy thing you can do on your own. Sodium sweat testing, I know some companies do that. And is there value in that? Maybe. I think if you are a heavier sweater with sodium concentration, you might get some value out of that. So I think those are a couple of things, you know, athletes could do in terms of testing. Beyond that, it would be like, you know, if you've got a lot of gut issues, getting worked up for IBS, celiac, other issues that would be causing those, I think that's probably a more productive use of time to at least make sure and rule out it's not any of those things before, you know, investing in other things that might not actually be the underlying issue.
Last question I have for you. For runners that are interested in what you do, what is either the frontier or the most exciting realm of digestion science right now? Like, what gets you up in the morning and you're like, this is exciting. I am stoked for what's on the horizon here in terms of breakthroughs.
Yeah, that's a good question. Me personally, a lot of my research in the last few years is more geared towards the interaction between psychology and nutrition and gut tolerance. So, I mean, I've done a number of studies now, just observational, that show people who have more anxiety are more likely to report gut issues with exercise. Now, those are just correlations, so I would not get carried away with those. So we are in the midst of doing some studies and designing some studies where we're trying to more experimentally show that mood state is an important potential player in how the gut responds with fueling and responds to feeding. So I guess, you know, in the next couple of years, hopefully we'll have some papers and studies that come out looking at that more experimentally. I think beyond my own research, though, I think it is the gut microbiome and how that impacts performance. There's a lot of interest in that, I think, for good reasons. I mean, the microbiome, or kind of this collection of microorganisms and everything that they produce, is known to impact physiology, mood, all sorts of stuff. And you know, whether there's a actual ability for us to manipulate that as a way to enhance performance or improve gut function with exercise, I think that's definitely something people will be looking more into. So I would expect that in the next 10 years, that's going to be an area where there's a lot of research that comes out. Not something that I specialize in personally in terms of my own research work, but I know that is one where people are very, very interested in it and working on it.
Awesome. Well, Patrick, we really appreciate your time here. I enjoyed the book, The Athlete's Gut. We'll make sure to link to it in the show notes of this episode, as well as any other relevant links. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Robert. I took away a lot of great information, including how to address symptoms of nausea, bloating, and cramping in running situations, the differences in fluid hydration protocols for events under and over 2 hours, the roles that carbs, fat, and protein play in race day nutrition strategies, whether supplementation with stuff like exogenous ketones makes sense, and tests that runners might consider taking to understand their body better and better inform their nutrition strategy. What were some of your takeaways? Please let us know in the comments section of this post on social media. Thank you so much for listening to the Run to the Top podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson. As always, our mission here is to help you become a better runner with every episode. Please consider connecting with me on Instagram at WasatchFinn and the rest of our team at Runners Connect. Also, consider supporting our show for free with a rating on the Spotify and Apple podcast players. And lastly, if you love the show and want bonus content, behind-the-scenes experiences with our guests, and premier access to contests and giveaways, then subscribe to our newsletter by going to runnersconnect.net/podcast. Until next time, happy training.